Hello and welcome back to part two of Julia Binoche, Good, Bad, Crazy edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
Brian.
Sean, we were at Liberté in the previous episode, and now we have encountered Tranquillité. Or have we not?
How do you say trapped in a dungeon in French?
I believe dungeon is a French word.
Okay.
Surely it must come from French. Donjon.
Okay. How do you say dying slow death in French?
Well, it's funny that we are saying the French translations of these words because the film we are going to talk about has a French title, mm-hmm. is set in a French town,
yes.
features a number of French actresses.
Does it?
Well, at least two.
Okay.
But it is entirely in English.
Yes.
Okay. This is what I call one of those sub-genres of, like, shitty movies that they don't make anymore, which is, like, European fantasy twaddle.
It's European magical realism twaddle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, am I being a snob here? Like, if a film is going to be set in a foreign country, and then there's like a random concoction of English and European actors walking around using some like ridiculous accent that's like halfway between a French accent and a fairy tale accent. I can get with it if it's like The Shop Around the Corner with Jimmy Stewart and Margaret O'Sullivan and we're meant to think they're in Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
But like something about seeing it in a film from the year 2000.
Y2K, baby.
It's just like, what world are we living in where we have to listen to Juliette Binoche play a French woman speaking in English?
Well, what do you prefer? Do you prefer when everyone tries to do a consistent accent?
I don't know. What would a consistent accent between Judi Dench, Alfred Molina, Lena Olin, Juliette Binoche, and Johnny Depp be?
Well, I mean, what I would have done if I was directing this film, I had to pass on it back in 2000. It was such a disaster. I would just get them to speak in their own accents.
Yeah, and a lot of them are sort of, I guess, speaking in something like their own accents, but Judi Dench definitely is not. She's giving, like, imperious French matriarch half the time.
Your cinnamon looks rancid.
Oh, well, it's not cinnamon. It's a special kind of chili pepper.
Chili pepper in hot chocolate?
Mm-hmm. It'll give you a lift.
But they're all just, like, slipping in and out of things. And wait till we get to Johnny Depp. But, Sean, actually, we've been so overcome by the inanity of this film that we have failed to say what it was called.
The film is called Chocolat, and it is without doubt the worst film that we have ever watched for this podcast.
Now, Sean, we have done a number of bad films, right? In fact, this whole series is called Good, Bad, Crazy. I seem to recall me foaming at the mouth over Love Actually. I seem to remember steam and fire coming out of your ears when we did Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
You're telling me that Chocolat surpasses them all.
It is one of the worst pieces of shit, chocolate-covered shit, that I have ever seen in my life. I'm glad we have that explicit E beside our episodes now, so I can say it is fucking shit.
Okay, can we identify why, though? I mean, like, you called Eat, Pray, Love repugnant. Is this movie repugnant?
This film is not repugnant, no. It is just pathetic. I've said this before in the podcast, and I'll say it again, because it only gives me more fuel for my fire, is that the early 2000s, especially 2000 onward, is a cultural wasteland. This film would never get made now because it is too crap to ever get made.
It's true. And I think the thing that nudges Chocolat over into being the worst we've ever done, Eat, Pray, Love, Hannibal, Theodore Rex, like, for the most part, these movies were not all that successful. Chocolat was nominated for Best Picture of the Year in the Academy Awards. And those were in the days where there were just five nominees.
That is disgusting.
Yes. Chocolat was nominated for Best Picture. It was nominated for Best Actress, Juliette Binoche.
Yeah, Supporting Actress, Judi Dench.
Yeah, and probably some
music,
other things. Yeah.
And screenplay.
I mean, this is... Oh. I mean, Harvey Weinstein has a lot of terrible things to his legacy, but Chocolat, in terms of the artistic sins, is very high up on that list.
It's interesting that you mentioned Harvey Weinstein there, because this is what we're going to have to do more of in the wake of his, I was going to say allegations, but like truth-telling from the poor women that he is completely abused over the years, is that his bullish, big-headed bollockness has caused films of this poor quality to be put out in the world and celebrated and awarded, and people scratching their head thinking, oh yeah, this is good, okay? He also, I believe, Chicago was also Miramax as well, which would have been Harvey Weinstein. So we also have him to blame for Chicago's
success. And The King's Speech.
Oh my god, I'm so angry!
Okay, now, to be fair, well, I don't want to say to be fair to Harvey, but to be fair to Miramax, they did also promote a lot of really good and really important films. Pulp Fiction was, you know, one of the early Miramax successes. I would say, actually, that the campaign for Shakespeare in Love was entirely merited that year.
You are a one-man band.
No, that is absolutely not true, Sean. Talk to any gay film critic who remembers 1998, okay? It was Saving Private Ryan, a masculine wank job versus an actually really accomplished female-centered romantic comedy, and it's amazing that Shakespeare in Love won. Now,
I haven't seen it.
Harvey probably twisted a few arms, but Shakespeare in Love is really good. And there are probably some other, you know, Miramax releases that we should all be thankful for bringing independent film into the mainstream. Chocolat is not one of them. I have a real history with this film, Chocolat. Do you care to hear about it, Sean?
Well, it's 50% your podcast too, Brian, so knock yourself out.
Okay. The history is actually nothing to do with having seen the film. I have never seen
it. Yeah, you saw it last night.
I know. I saw it last night. I'd never seen it before. But I remember in the year 2000, this title, Chocolat, was always on the tip of my tongue, along with dear, dear friend and friend of the podcast, Scott Hoffa.
Scott Hoffa.
Scott Hoffa and I hope he's listening to this now.
Hoffa.
Because to us, the title Chocolat was like the epitome of like bad middlebrow movie wankery. I can remember us, any opportunity we got to mention it in our improv comedy sketch troupe, we would just look at one another and go, Chocolat? Chocolat. Like, this movie became synonymous to us for everything that was bad, stupid, and pointless in cinema. I never thought that I'd actually get around to watching it, Sean. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to finally confirm what I have suspected for 18 years.
I'm sorry that you're going to have to die knowing that you've seen Chocolat. I mean, it's pretty sad we would go, really.
The other thing that I want to provide some context for you, Sean, is like what makes Chocolat's success in 2000 like even more cynical and derivative is like there was a whole kind of trend of movies. It's not quite food porn movies. Like, there are definitely food porn movies that exist. Some of them excellent, like Big Night. Some of them perhaps debatable, like Julie and Julia. But I would put Chocolat in a very late 90s, early 2000s trend of food-based magical realism.
Yeah, also, I was going to say liberation through food.
Yeah, it's liberation through food, but with a kind of spiritual edge.
Yeah, I can name two that I thought of all by myself, in fact. There was a really bad Sarah Michelle Gellar feature film, one of her few feature films, called, I believe, like Simply Irresistible or something, where she actually is kind of magical. She's kind of like a witch who puts a spell on her guys with the lobster rolls she makes or something. And then there's this film with Penelope Cruz, which I used to see the trailer for at one point on all the VHS from Kieran's video store, called Woman on Top. There's no magic in it, as far as I know, apart from her bountiful bosom is pretty magical, don't you think?
And darling, she's some sort of Spanish chef who arrives and...
Well, she's from Brazil in this.
Oh, she's Brazilian.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder how her Brazilian accent compares to Javier's in Eat, Pray, Love. But, like, Eat, Pray, Love has a bit of this, like, food will save you. But yeah. What I'm thinking of is films like Water for Chocolate. Have you ever heard of that film?
No, I have heard of, like, Water for Elephants, though.
That's all other matter. As far as I know, elephants are not food in most cultures. Maybe what? Barack Obama ate one as a side dish when he ate that dog in Indonesia. I don't know.
Oh my god.
You know that, right?
I know about the dog, but... Yeah.
Maybe he ate an elephant too. I don't know.
This is how fake news gets created.
Okay, yeah, sorry, sorry. Suppress that. Suppress it. Oh, I edit this myself. Okay, note to self. Anyway, like Water for Chocolate, which I never saw, was a big indie art house hit when I was kind of like in high school. And as far as I know, it's based on a Mexican novel, or maybe it's an English novel set in Mexico. Anyway, by a woman named Laura Esquivel. And it's like the patriarchy, the oppressiveness of the culture is all, you know, subverted by the fact that this woman has these like magical recipes that she makes with chocolate, and she like weeps into the chocolate and the tears like make people do all sorts of crazy things.
Now, I hate the sound of it.
Yeah, you hate the sound of it because you just saw that movie, okay. Didn't you?
I did.
I mean, isn't that the exact same plot line as Chocolat?
Except there's no crying. Juliette Binoche, we should say, doesn't get sad in this film, really, does she?
She does cry at one point, which we can get to with Johnny Depp in the scene of coitus. But, like, who is...
Who doesn't cry after coitus?
I would say, in some ways, like, they've taken the tradition, the grand tradition of magical realism, you know, initiated by Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Isabel Allende, perverted and dampened down through terrible Hollywood films like The House of the Spirits. Like, it just, Hollywood tried to do magical realism, they couldn't.
Would you call Death Becomes Her magical realism?
No, Death Becomes Her is just a satirical comedy. Like, magical realism is particularly has a Latin American flavor to it, yeah? And it's about trying to, like, combine folkloric elements with sort of, you know, stories often of sexuality, spirituality, history, things like that. But it really, I defy anyone to ever point to a major English language film where it is actually... come across, yeah? Mm. And worked well.
That's actually a very fair observation. Oh, I have thought of one, but it's bad. Mm-hmm. It's Vanilla Sky.
Well, which was obviously based on a Spanish film first and then remade, yeah? I mean, I think the thing with Chocolat is, like, it's a purely cynical exercise. They're literally taking, like, a paint-by-numbers version of this kind of stuff, and it's now been reduced down to its, like, absolute sugary... edgeless
jus
essence. Yeah, it's just like, it's, do you know what it's like?
It's toffee.
It's like, you know, obviously some sugary treats are delicious and have lots of flavor, and then others are just like marshmallow.
I was just gonna say marshmallow.
Yeah, marshmallow or cotton candy, which you would call...
I would call it candy floss, I suppose.
Exactly.
All right.
Candy floss, cotton candy.
There's a quiz there.
You know, or those little things you get at Easter, those little like chicken, what are they called? Peeps, you know, that you just kind of eat them and they're just like literally puffed sugar.
I've never heard of anything you're talking about.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying is like sugary treats that have absolutely no content, no flavor, no quality.
They're basically Maltesers, but minus the deliciousness.
Yes. And it's funny that we bring up Easter because on the one hand, we have chocolate provided by Juliette Binoche, which is the engine of liberation in this film. And then on the other hand, we have other totemic force, which is the engine of conformity and repression.
Yeah, which is not eating chocolate.
I guess, not eating chocolate, but why can they not eat chocolate? Oh, what is going on?
What is Lent?
Yes, so Juliet arrives in this little French town in the middle of Lent. And this is really like the crux of the entire fucking movie, yeah? No one can eat chocolate during Lent. She wants to sell them on chocolate.
We're glad to be so near the church, though.
Well, enjoy singing with the bells, won't we, Nuno?
The bells are not intended as an entertainment, madame. They are a solemn call to worship for the...
Mademoiselle.
I beg your pardon?
Mademoiselle, I've never been married, but feel free to call me Vianne. I do hope you'll stop by when I open for business next week.
Yes. Yes, opening a patisserie during the Holy Lenten fast, I could imagine better timing.
Oh, but it's not going to be a patisserie.
Then what do you intend to...
It's a surprise.
Can I even boil it down to an even more saccharine jus?
Uh-huh.
This is a film for adults.
Nominally.
Nominally, that is based around eating chocolate.
Yeah.
That is what this film is about. Okay, I don't care what other kind of, like, symbolism you can find. If that is what your story hinges on, you have nothing else to go on.
Well, I guess, but is it, yes, it's a film for adults, but isn't it like a film for the kind of adult who goes to like Picture House Central and is like, ooh, look at this artisanal Guatemalan Chilean chocolate with salted caramel and lavender. This will be delightful. I'll pay £7.50 for this, you know? Yeah. It's like what kind of adult. What film are they seeing in 2018?
Yeah. They're paying £7.50 for hot chocolates.
Victoria and Abdul, okay. Possibly.
Yeah, I can get with that.
And they're saying, I can taste the Orient in this.
It's like, wow, Judi Dench just knocks it out of the park again. That woman is iconic.
But there is a kind of person who, like, eats a bar of chocolate or a chocolate cake and just savors the rich, tasty aroma and thinks that they're somehow being sophisticated. I mean, you've said this about, you know, all sorts of foods like cupcakes and everything. I mean, this might as well be her opening up a cupcake shop, you know?
Yes, but if that was the story, she would come and she would open up a cupcake shop and then people would realize that she's a fascist and she would be driven out of town.
Instead, she's a pagan who's bringing the kind of pagan spirit of the Mayan chocolate. In fact, the chocolaterie that she opens is called
Maya.
Chocolaterie Maya.
Maya.
Maya. So we have this like opposition between paganism and Catholicism. Who is representing Catholic authoritarian repression in this film?
It's that gargolic delight, Alfred Molina.
Now, what do you think about Alfred Molina, Sean?
He always feels like a part-time actor. Do you know what I mean?
No, I don't know what you mean.
Alfred Molina is one of those people where I'm like, oh yeah, Alfred Molina, he's a thing, you know?
He's very big. He's a big man.
He's very good in Spider-Man 2.
He's good in Spider-Man 2. He's good as Diego Rivera in Frida. And he's excellent as murderous lover Kenneth Halliwell in Prick Up Your Ear.
Yes, which now, dear listeners, because Brian and I have two rooms in our flat, I can watch Prick Up Your Ears without feeling that one of us is going to murder the other.
Yeah, I did worry if Sean ever saw the story of Joe Orton and his lover living in one small room and then killing one another, that it would give him too many notions.
And I'm full of notions, as we all know.
But here's the thing with Alfred Molina. It's like, I like Alfred Molina. I have a lot of goodwill toward him. But he's often, like, in the really the shittiest roles. I felt the same way about him in Feud when he was Bob Aldrich. Like,
oh, yeah, that was shit.
It's like he's a very workable actor. He'll just show up and he'll do anything. And in this, what is his motivation? I mean, he has to deliver lines. Like, Juliet has just come and decided to open up a chocolate shop, okay? And it happens to be at the start of Lent. And he says things to her like, this is scandalous. The nerve of this woman. She's shameless. This is temptation. And you're just like, okay, maybe if this was set in like the fucking Middle Ages, I could buy this as being some kind of motivation. What year is this nominally meant to be taking place?
Well, they mentioned that the war was 15 years ago, and then they clarified that World War I came before this 15 years ago, which means if World War II ended in 1945, then this is 1960.
Okay, and they're in some kind of sleepy, absolutely, completely unrealistic, quote-unquote, 1960 fairy tale village, which there'll be occasional little hints of things that are like the 60s. Like, there's a scene in a hair salon where they have, like, those, you know, permanent wave headdress things that the women put on.
Nobody has perm.
I know, it's just like
these people quote unquote live.
It really doesn't feel like the 1960s, and I suppose that you're meant to think like this is a village trapped in time, but like honestly, it neuters the entire film of any kind of relevance, right? Like, this is a post-war, post-Nazi occupation French village. Alfred Molina is the Comte de Raynaud. He's the, like, local nobleman who seems to have everyone under his thumb. Rather than, I don't know, there could have been something interesting about exploring, like, his collaboration with the fascists in the past. Like, if Elena Ferrante had been writing this, do you know what I mean? There would all be these, like, submerged secrets of how the war had brought out all these issues. None of that is present here. He just fucking hates chocolate.
You know what else is funny? It's like he has the priest of the town under his thumb.
When,
like,
who's a cute little twink.
He's cute enough. But the thing about this is, like, if the church was the real opposition, I'd kind of get into it a bit, because that makes sense, okay? He is just some busybody with a title
And a lot of money, presumably.
Who makes everybody's life, you know, hellish.
Well, we're meant to think that he has that kind of, like, self-flagellating faith that, like, he wants to go around hypocritically criticizing everyone, you know, and it's all about how much people are breaking all the rules. And he makes reference to his ancestors, the previous counts who, like, expelled the Huguenots from the village, and now, you know, his adversary is Juliette Binoche with her cacao nibs, you know?
I hate that word.
Nibs or cacao?
Cacao. It's like, oh, it's made with delicious raw cacao. Get it away from me, then. Just take it away.
Well, that's what chocolate comes from, darling.
Yeah, but cacao, it is honestly, it's a lifestyle choice, cacao. Oh, would you like some of this chia seeds flavored with cacao? Get away from me!
Tell that to the peasant farmers of Guatemala. Okay.
They don't understand what I'm saying.
Well, so the other film that this reminds me of, and it's like a pale imitation of, is Mary Poppins.
Oh, yeah. Ugh.
Do you want to just enumerate why and how?
Well, I mean, Mary Poppins in itself is a fairy tale where someone, it's that classic, actually, Mary Poppins is a bit like Teorema, I've just realized. It is. Yeah. So basically, it's that story where an outsider comes to town that is in a place of stagnation, changes their lives, gets involved with them, and then leaves.
Yeah,
it's Teorema.
Well, but also, like, Mary Poppins is obviously a semi-mystical being who, like, arrives on an umbrella when the wind changes, yeah. You know, and comes with a carpet bag. This is literally how Juliette Binoche arrives in town. Like, are we meant to think that Juliette Binoche and her daughter are human beings, or do they have some kind of, like, mystical... Like, there's a scene, all the whole town is in the church listening to some boring homily about how they shouldn't, you know, indulge during Lent, and then, like, the wind blows in, and the doors of the church, like, fly open. And then who's walking down the street but Juliette Binoche in a scarlet brazen red cloak, ready to buy up the old patisserie and turn it into her chocolate emporium. Are we meant to think, like, she's the right person to arrive in this town thanks to the wind?
Well, I don't think at any point is she ever supposed to be considered sinister. This is the thing. She is this exotic bird. She's like the parakeets that live in the trees in Finsbury Park, you know? Uh-huh. She's come to make our lives a bit brighter.
But I guess what I'm saying is, like, is she even a three-dimensional person? Or is she just, like, literally the embodiment of freedom and self-liberation?
Well, she is mystical, and that is free to admit, because she tells her daughter this little irritating little child.
Yeah, honestly, the most irritating girl who's ever been in any film.
She tells her daughter a bedtime story about what is essentially her grandfather, who, like, got involved with a woman who is, like, in a rainforest and had...
Well, it was in Mexico, I think, somewhere. Yeah.
And had, like, magical powers.
And discovered chocolate. The secret of cacao.
Yeah, discovered the secret of cacao.
He ate, like, unrefined cacao.
Yeah, and then he got all, like, he fell in love with her and they had passion.
One night, he was invited to drink unrefined cacao with a pinch of chili. The very same drink the ancient Maya used in their sacred ceremonies. The Maya believed cacao held the power to unlock hidden yearnings and reveal destinies.
But because the power of the cacao is just too intense, that she was cursed, her daughter, her child was cursed to wander the, I don't know, rainforest.
Like, from place to place and never stay one place. But this is what I mean, like, is this a fucking Greek myth or, like, a Mayan, like, origin story?
Like,
or,
make your mind up.
Or is she just a real person who's, like, started a capitalist enterprise of selling chocolate in this town? Like, we haven't described Juliette Binoche's marketing technique, okay?
Oh, I think it's quite clever, actually.
We'll give you this one for free, people. You don't have to go to Harvard Business School to learn this. If you really want to trick people into buying things that they don't need at high markups, what you should do is get a lot of, like, Mayan artifacts and, like, arrange them around your chocolate shop. But one in particular is very important. And what is that, Sean?
Yeah, it's this magical wheel of fortune where it's basically like if I spun a color wheel and said, what color do you see? Okay. Mm-hmm. You don't see anything, right? And then you make it up. You say, oh, I see lavender. Okay. This is my wheel now, not hers. Okay.
Yeah.
In her wheel, basically, she spins this like drawing so fast it becomes nothing. Okay,
well, it's kind of like a sculpt.
It's like a
sculptural Rorschach test.
Yeah, it's a sculptural Rorschach test if it was like a spinning top as well.
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like to you? Just say the first thing that comes into your mind. A woman riding a wild horse. Silly answer.
Oh no, there are no silly answers. The Pepper Triangle, that's for you.
It's going at a million miles a minute, and you're like, oh, I see a bird. And she's like, oh, you see a bird? Here, try this.
Yeah, and then Judi Dench is like, I see a grumpy old woman. And she's like, you deserve a cup of hot chocolate with a touch of chili. And then Judi Dench is like, chili in hot chocolate? Never!
But you know what? I can remember the first time I had chili with hot chocolate. I can. I remember I was in Cork. I was in the English Market in Cork. And I think I was in university by the time I had... Oh, yeah. This is like 2008. Oh, my God, I'm going on a journey. It was 2008, and I was in Cork, and I had chili with chocolate, and I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Ladies and gentlemen, just in case you didn't know, I've started spinning the disc, and that's what's prompted Sean to go into his reverie. Okay, Sean, I'm glad that you have this wonderful memory of the first time you had chili and chocolate. Can I ask you a question, though? Having had that, did you then write a screenplay about it?
Actually, I wrote a two-act play that's currently on in the Young Vic.
The point is, it's not worthy. It's not worthy of all this attention. Like, there is, like, scene after scene of her spinning the disc and then people being like, I see a skull. And then other people are like, I feel the snow. I feel the cold. I feel the air. What about you, Morales? What do you feel?
Well, I see nothing.
Exactly. There is nothing here. It's like the fucking Emperor's New Clothes. And I have to say, like... the level on which Juliette Binoche is an actual entrepreneur is very, like, elided in this film because, like, occasionally she does say to someone, that'll be $4.50. But then she also seems to be giving away a lot of chocolate as well and kind of, like, turning this chocolate into, like, a kind of a cult. Did you think she was mostly motivated by the profit motive here?
It's kind of like, you know the way when you're like, campaigning for either an election or a referendum or something... They say that, honestly, the best way to change anybody's mind is not through, like, the literature, but to, like, knock on their door and talk to them and whatever, okay? So basically, instead of saying, here's a free sample, she's saying, you look sad. Come in. I have something for you. So she personalizes it. Okay, imagine this.
She's a cult leader.
Yeah.
She's L. Ron Hubbard. She's a drug dealer.
Yeah.
That's basically what she is. I'm siding with Alfred Molina here.
You know what I like to think, okay? Imagine that it's, like, closing time and there's, like, nothing else in the shop, okay? And she has, like, one kind of, like, bitter lemon chocolate, like, right behind the counter. And someone comes in and she's, like, and she spins the wheel and, like, what do you see? And they're, like, I see strawberries, a field of strawberries. And she's, like, I have the perfect chocolate for you here, okay? And it's this bitter lemon thing. And they're, like, ugh, this is horrible. And it's, like... No, it's not. It's perfect for you.
The disc says it's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
It's like when you serve a pint, okay, by accident to someone, and you put the pint out of sight, and then someone says, oh, pot and Foster's, please, mate. You're like, okay, all right. And then you just give them the one you poured earlier.
She's a fucking... She's a fucking con artist.
I've never done that.
Okay, so... The number of people that she tricks and, like, ropes into this cult, right? Like, it's just such a fucking predictable story because it's, like, all the misfits of the town are gonna band together around Juliette Binoche and, like, become... They are sort of become, like, free labor in the chocolaterie at one point.
What's another word for labor, Brian?
Slaves?
Slaves. They become slaves.
I don't know about slaves. I think it's... Judith's more like... It's like Wild Wild Country. And she's like...
She's Bhagwan.
No, she's... What's her name?
Sheila.
Sheila. Sheila Anand.
Just Sheila.
Ma Anand Sheila. You know? She's this like charismatic young woman who is like essentially getting everyone to do her bidding of making and selling chocolate and eating chocolate and consuming all the chocolate.
I want to point out to the listeners, we are having a really good time doing this. I want to reiterate how much I hate this film.
Yeah, well, I'm actually enjoying our retelling of it, where she's like an evil capitalist overlord who's like addicting them to sugar. Because that is a movie I would much prefer to see than the insipid film that we did see. It's based on a book, apparently.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Like, what section of the bookshop do you think this book was stacked in?
Well, you know, Brian, given that the 2000s was a cultural wasteland, it was probably stacked in contemporary literature.
It's probably a fucking Oprah's Book Club book. I don't know. That's denigrating to poor Oprah. Okay, can we just enumerate among the many people who fall under the spell of Juliet's spinning wheel? Like, there's quite a lot of acclaimed actors in this film.
Yes, there's Judi Dench, okay, who, for the first time ever, is doing an accent. Honestly, never heard her do one before.
Well, I mean, she does an accent in Philomena.
Oh, God.
I think she probably does it. I think she probably does an accent in Murder on the Orient Express as some kind of weird European countess. But, yeah, okay.
Okay, pointing out at least that Judi Dench rarely does accents.
She rarely does accents, and it's really hard to tell what accent she's doing here except for grumpy old European lady, which is kind of the accent, yeah? Mm-hmm. She's in the kind of sour Judi Dench mode, but then she kind of warms, like the chocolate itself, melting.
Well, that's how you get an Academy Award nomination.
So she's a kind of grandmother who is estranged from her grandson. Now, this plotline, really, it's the engine of a lot of the so-called narrative. Like, did you even have a handle on why her daughter didn't talk to her and didn't want the grandson to hang out with her?
Well, later on, it is revealed that she has diabetes. But after that was, you know, and she's obviously eating chocolate and she shouldn't be. But after that was over, I was like, I turned to you and was like, wait, what else does she do?
It's honestly, Judi Dench's daughter, the mother of the grandson, is like the secretary or something for Alfred Molina. So she's like aligned with all the, you know, revanchist conservative forces in the town. Judi Dench is just an old lady who, like, is the landlady of the chocolate shop. The daughter has just basically been like, you can never see your grandson, you can never hang out with him because you pamper him too much. And I want him to, like, eat healthy food and, like, you know, not get ill and do his homework and stuff. And it's like, so don't go visit your grandmother. Okay. Then she explains it like, actually, mother, you have not acknowledged to anyone that you're diabetic. So the logic we're meant to understand is, my mother is diabetic, therefore I deny her access to her grandson?
Yes.
Like, if you want to drive your mother towards an early grave, like, deny them access to their grandchildren, of course she's going to sit eating fucking mounds of chocolate. She's got nothing better to do. Her entire family has disowned her.
Exactly. Like,
and this also,
she's ill.
This also plays into the Juliette Binoche as, like, drug pusher, like, element of this, because even after Juliette Binoche is revealed to her that Judy does not have a functioning pancreas, she's still, like, pushing mounds of chocolate. And I'm sure she would, like, you know, justify it by saying, like, well, Judy chose it. It was absolutely of her free will, you know, but, you know, like, she even has a whole, like, fucking party with all sorts of sweets and, like, chocolate festival, and it's like, this is, like, basically a Klaus von Bülow attempt to, like, kill off Judi Dench with too much sugar in this film.
I love the reference, Brian, I really do.
Mm-hmm. It's a reversal of fortune.
It is.
Okay, so that's the Judi Dench plotline. There's also some other, can we just name check some of the other people?
Let's at least name check.
And
them.
These are, like, Oscar nominees and, like, acclaimed art house performers of the time. So there's Emily Watson.
Yeah. I don't know how much to say about her because Emily Watson's never really on my radar.
Yeah, okay, but, like, what? She's just, like, a mousy woman who
gets, breaking the waves, that's her.
Yeah, breaking the waves. Hillary and Jackie, yeah. So she's just, like, a mousy woman who has a kind of stagnant marriage with her husband, but all she has to do is give him some cacao nibs, and he's, like, ready to, like, violate her while she's, like, scrubbing the kitchen floor.
Yeah, do you know what? If you just re-edited that scene even slightly, it would be sexual assault.
Yeah, I mean, the implication is that she wants this because she brings these magical chocolates home to him, and then she's, like, desperate to get more of them, so this is some kind of, like, Viagra laced, you know, chocolate bar.
Nougat with Viagra.
We gasped in the credits because this film is actually a reunion of Juliette Binoche with some of her former co-stars, one of them being acclaimed grande dame of French cinema, Leslie Caron.
Wasted.
Yeah, I think there were some scenes with Leslie Caron that got cut out of the film.
There's always that kind of suggestion, isn't there, when someone who's bigger and more important than they are, has a really tepid role in something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is just an old lady who by the end, like, you know, ends up renouncing her widow's weeds and getting with some other old guy who has a lovable dog.
Widow's weeds?
You remember Judi Dench had a lovable dog in Tea with Mussolini.
Yeah.
It's nothing like an old character actor with a lovable dog.
Yeah, so you know the sad thing is, okay, you know in Damage where she shows up, okay? Basically, Leslie Caron's entrance in Damage and her few scenes therein are just incredible. You know?
Absolutely.
And in this, she might as well be standing in the back of a group shot.
She might as well be a figurine from Madame Tussauds. That's the amount of personality she has in this. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, a slightly larger role is given to Lena Olin.
Yeah.
Now, is Lena Olin an actress who means anything to you, Sean?
Zero. Okay, but you know who is an actress that means something to me? Barbara Hershey, who looks an awful lot like Lena Olin, apparently.
Hershey's chocolate?
Yeah, it's all related. So every time Lena Olin was on screen, I was like, it's Barbara Hershey, and she's all right.
Lena Olin nowadays isn't in a lot of things. Her last major role that I can remember is in The Reader. Did you see The Reader?
I haven't seen The Reader. I have seen The Reader.
Do you remember the... Do you remember the modern-day frame story in The Reader that involved Ralph Fiennes?
Jeez, barely.
Yeah, it's like Ralph Fiennes...
at the very end.
It's like, I think they returned to it a few times because Ralph Fiennes is like the little boy who knew Kate Winslet, like all grown up, and he goes to meet someone who is played by Lena Olin. I think she's either like Kate Winslet's daughter or something or other. Like, Lena Olin, to me, is one of those people who can be like... any European nationality. Like, I don't know what nationality she really is. She's probably, like, Czech or Croatian or Slovenian or something.
Oh, she's Scandinavian, I think. Olin. This is the Lassie Hallström connection, okay?
Possibly.
Because there's Peter Stormare, who we're going to mention in a moment, and I'm pretty sure Lena Olin is Scandinavian. I also wanted to point out that there might be a reason why I don't remember much about The Reader is because I was making out a lot during the watching of that
film. You were making out while watching The Reader?
Yeah.
A film about a Nazi prison guard.
Yeah, I was watching
who's illiterate.
I was watching it with a guy at the time, and we made out a lot.
This is too much information. A pedophiliac illiterate Nazi.
Yes, she is. Okay.
Yes, she is. She's right up there with Sheba Hart.
Yeah, you didn't know that, did you? I never told you that.
The things that come out when these microphones are turned on, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, so Lena Olin, her other teaming with Juliette Binoche, do you know what it's in?
No.
Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Which I found out was a film yesterday.
It is a film and a novel by Milan Kundera. They're meant to be like Czech radicals, and there's lots of sexiness between them with like bowler hats and underwear and all sorts of stuff. And
bowler hats are never sexy, Brian.
They are if a nubile young Juliette Binoche is wearing one and little else. Or a nubile young Lena Olin.
Ooh.
Anyway, in this one, she plays... Okay, so you've got the local atheist who runs the chocolaterie. You've got conservative lord, you've got a priest, you've got a grumpy old lady, you've got little children. What other type of character does every single village need to have?
A sexy wanderer?
Yes, that'll be Johnny Depp, but I mean Lena Olin. You have to have...
Oh, a horrible husband.
Yes, a horrible husband to a mad woman.
Oh, yes.
You don't have a mad woman.
Who's the mad woman again?
Lena Olin.
Oh, she's mad.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought she was just foreign.
I mean, I don't know what she is. Like, she's crazy. She's, like, walking around mumbling and muttering and pickpocketing other people. And she's kind of, like, abused and beat up by her husband, Peter Stormare. And eventually she gets taken in by Juliette Binoche, and this, like, sweet feminine attention from this other woman is exactly what Lena Olin needs to kind of, like, calm down and re-enter normal society.
You don't misbehave here. It's just not done. Did you know that? If you don't go to confession, or if you don't dig your flower beds, or if you don't pretend, nothing more in your life than to serve your husband 3 meals a day and give him children and vacuum under his ass, then you're crazy.
in relation to Lena Olin's friendship with Juliette Binoche, okay, at the very start of the film, we clearly see her steal something from a woman's bag, okay? And I am 99% sure that she gives that little, whatever it is.
It's like a compact. Yeah, it's like a gold compact.
She gives it to Juliette Binoche, and when she gives it to her, I'm like, oh, Brian, this is going to be important later. She's going to use it in the town square, and someone's going to accuse her of something. And it doesn't happen.
No. There's virtually no plot in this film. And if we haven't conveyed it yet, like, we might be painting this as if it's some delightful French version of, like, a Bruegel painting that's, like, full of colorful characters doing, you know, delightful things, you know, jumping over barrels. It's none of that. This movie is the most slow-paced of, like, any film that is, like, nominally, quote-unquote, delightful that I have ever seen. Like,
nominally delightful. That'd be good in the poster.
It's really, like, nominally delightful. Like, the pacing of this film is so slow. The blocking, like, all the sets are too big so that people are, like, standing too far apart from one another. Do you know what I mean? Like, every scene has this, like, soporific pace to it. There's nothing manic or nothing pixie-ish about it. It's just literally plodding along. You kind of waiting for, like, Alfred Molina to, like, make some kind of massive campaign to, like, shut down what Juliette Binoche is doing. And he never really does. The only person who sort of takes measures into his own hands is the aforementioned husband of Lena Olin, Peter Stormare, who gets kind of, like, violent at a couple of points. And this also stuck out like a sore thumb. Do you remember the bit where he breaks into the chocolaterie to, like, get Lena Olin back, and then he and Juliette have a fight?
Yes, I do.
And he literally, like, starts strangling her.
Yeah.
Like, that seemed completely out of tone with the rest of the movie.
Yeah. There are all these things that I thought were going to ratchet film up into fourth gear. Is that a car gear?
It is.
Yeah, yes. Fourth gear. One was that when they have that fight and he gets hit over the head, I'm like, oh my god, he's dead.
And they're going to have to bury him, yeah, or be accused of murder.
Yeah.
Nope, not dead.
The next thing was, I was like, oh, it's going to happen at the end. They're going to chase the Alfred Molina character out of town. And you were like, no, babe, it's going to be revealed that he has a heart of gold. And it might not quite gold, but silver at least.
Well, at least he has a taste for, spoiler alert, chocolate. Okay, the thread of plot that we've not talked about, okay, involves Johnny Depp, who is everywhere on the posters of this film. Like, when this film came out, I kind of thought it was, like, some whimsical rom-com between Juliet and Johnny Depp, and she is his love interest, but he doesn't come into the movie until far, 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 far into it.
That's fine with me. I really don't like him.
Okay, Johnny Depp is great when he's great, right? And probably this was around the time where he was starting to veer into not being great, yeah? Kind of delivering sort of mechanical quirkiness again and again.
There was Pirates of the Caribbean a couple of years later, which was a big moment for him. The only Johnny Depp that I like is in A Nightmare on Elm Street.
How about Ed Wood?
You like that more than I do.
Ooh, snap. Ladies and gentlemen, go back and listen to our Ed Wood episode and see if Sean is lying then or now.
I'm always lying, darling. You know this.
It's because of all the chocolate you eat with your nefarious ways. So, yeah, how about Sleepy Hollow? Don't you like him in that?
Ichabod Crane? Really like that film.
That's what I'm saying. Like, right. Johnny Depp, when he is really playing strange quirkiness, he can do it really well. But then, by, you know, a certain point in his career, he really starts phoning it in. In this one, he's like some kind of person from a traveler community who, like, comes in on a boat with a whole bunch of other people, and he, like, plays music on traditional instruments. They really have nothing to do with anything except that Juliet and he kind of start flirting with each other. But, okay, what country is Johnny Depp supposed to be from?
He's from, well, you could say he's from nowhere, except he signposts where he's from. Not just the accent, but he actually says, this thing is the finest thing from Ireland, he says with an Irish accent. And you pointed out quite cleverly that he's just doing a Bono impression.
He literally looks like Bono, he kind of acting like Bono.
Tell me something. Why do you give a damn about what these narrow-minded villagers think? You're not scared of them, are you?
Coming to the party or not?
I can't. There's a boycott against immorality, and I must respect that.
You know that Johnny Depp, when he played Ichabod Crane in Sleepy Hollow, said he was basing it off of Angela Lansbury in Death in the Nile.
Oh,
do you know this?
No, I didn't know this.
Yeah. So I'm sure if all the publicity tour for Chocolat, he was like, yeah, I'm just basing this character off of Bono. Because it kind of makes total sense. But here's my question for you, Sean.
Lansbury, wow.
Yeah. See? Your mind.
That's blown. That is kind of amazing, though.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, if Juliet is speaking to Judy in kind of French-accented English, we're meant to think that they're speaking in French to one another, yeah? And we're just going with the movie's convention that we're hearing it in English, even though it's French.
That's cool.
So when Johnny Depp shows up with an Irish accent, and he's speaking to everyone, what language is he speaking in?
Yeah, I know.
Is he speaking in Irish-accented French, or is he, like, speaking English, or, like, what the fuck is all this? This is where the logic of the movie just, like, completely breaks down, yeah. You know? This is why I love a good subtitle. Why can't we just have subtitles, you know?
Oh, that would have not gone down with any audiences.
Ugh.
Because, can I say something? The reason Chocolat was a success is because everything that we find to be pathetic in filmmaking actually generates a lot of money.
Sometimes, yeah. Or at least with Harvey's massive PR machine behind it, it can be, like, considered a success for about 5 minutes at the end of the year during award season. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like all this, like, puffing up of these movies that Harvey and Miramax did, they immediately deflate, right? It's like you have a souffle that, like, puffs up really big, gets a bunch of nominations, and then collapses. Actually, Harvey was behind The Reader as well.
Oh.
This was his thing, like, ramming in some movies that nobody really wanted to see. We haven't dealt with the, like, major catastrophe in the plot that happens, which is a giant conflagration.
Conflagration? Is that a fire on a barge?
Yes.
Oh, that's actually a word.
Conflagration, yeah, it's a massive fire.
Oh, right, okay. Yes, there's a fire on a barge, set by Peter Stormare,
who just wants revenge on everyone, so he sets fire to a barge when they're all having a hoedown with Johnny Depp and all the river rats. And again, we thought to ourselves, oh my god, Juliette Binoche's daughter is going to die, and this is going to be, you know, some horrible moment of tragedy, a turning point in the plot. There's a moment where we think she might be dead, and then she just runs up.
It's not even a full moment. It is half a moment for you to think she's dead, and then she's there.
Yeah, and this all happens when Johnny and Juliet are kind of copulating on a sort of sub-barge that's kind of, like, branched out from the main barge, and they're, like,
a docked barge.
No, it's kind of floating. It's like, do you remember, it's all lit up and stuff, and it's floating down the river quite romantically. This was the one scene where Juliet gets a bit upset and cries because she's like, oh, you know, I am traveling the world with my daughter. Why can't we just stay in one place all the time?
Oh, my God.
And then Johnny Depp takes advantage of this moment to, like, come on to her, and then they're having sex.
Then come into her.
And not noticing that there's smoke and there's fire all around the place. Okay, the fire ought to be a major turning point in the story. It's not. No one dies. Someone does die, and that's Judi Dench. She's had a big 70th birthday party. She's eaten way too much sugar. She passes away. Everybody's sad for a little bit of time. The wind starts to turn. Alfred Molina is, you know, continuing to try and boycott the chocolaterie, and Juliet is like, now that the wind has turned, I must leave. And her daughter's like, why do we have to leave, maman? Why can't we stay here with my character that we have yet to mention? Invisible imaginary kangaroo.
I don't want to talk about that. I really don't.
Because she has no friends, because she moves from place to place with her peripatetic mother, she has an imaginary kangaroo named Pantouf.
Again, I don't want to talk about this. This is just... It is just... I'm getting so angry.
There's only two words to describe this film. They're at the top of page 2 of my notes. Insipid and soporific.
I would prefer bull and shit myself, but we'll use your words. I think when we were watching this, I was like, gosh, Brian, imagine at the very end of this, there's, like, a huge massacre in the town. Like, it's one of those films where I was like, I was literally imagining anything else on the screen.
Well, instead what we have, poor Alfred Molina, like, he honestly deserves the Purple Heart for, like, going through this movie, because he decides, after all this has happened, and it's nearly Easter, and Juliet is going to stage a, quote-unquote, festival of fertility featuring chocolate. Lena Olin and all the others who've, like, sided with Juliet, they're, like, literally making, like, mini Venuses of Willendorf out of, like, you know...
chocolate.
Melted chocolate.
Chocolate? Is it chocolate?
It's like boobs made of chocolate, you know, like phalluses made of chocolate. And they're going to have this big festival with all this pagan chocolate. And so Alfred Molina breaks into the chocolaterie late at night, and he's ready to hack the chocolate. And he, like, whacks it with, like, a knife. And wouldn't you know, a tiny little droplet of chocolate, like, lands on his tongue. And
his lizard tongue.
And what is that enough to do to him, Sean?
He realizes only then does he like chocolate.
It's not just that he likes chocolate, but he has human emotions, longings, hungers, and pleasures. And so he gorges himself on all sorts of chocolate and wakes up, like, hungover in the shop window, having not indulged himself for the 40 days of Lent. All of this is taking place over 40 days, by the way, we should say. You know, from the time she moves into the chocolate place till now. And then suddenly, he has a heart of gold, chocolate is fine, the priest delivers a kind of humanist homily about how Jesus should be considered for his human foibles and not for his, like, divine commands and strictures.
Hey, I'm cool with that part.
No, that was all fine. It's just, like, the kind of thing that you tell to a 12-year-old, okay. Not the sort of thing that's for adults.
And then the very end of it, okay? Just to really get my goat up.
Or get your goat, or was it a marsupial?
Yeah, just to really piss me off. There's a kangaroo, a real one.
The invisible kangaroo has suddenly materialized through some kind of final feat of magic and hops away.
Do you know, I was so mad that I set fire to the house after this was over. Really, I did.
Okay, we're going to compliment only two things from the film, okay? Number one, in the flashback sequence, yeah, where we learn about...
Oh, we're going to compliment this, are we?
Well, I'm going to ask you what you thought of it. So in the flashback sequence where we learn about Juliette Binoche's father, the one who went off and, like, discovered cacao, you said that the actor bore a striking resemblance to someone.
Yeah, you, circa 2000. It was definitely you. I turned to you and said, that's you. And you said, yeah, it is...
I had a particular look, which some listeners may recall if you knew me in the last year of my university days in 2000. I've never quite had that look again. It was kind of during my, it has to be said, Freddie Prinze Jr. phase, you know? There I was on the cover of Teen People, and apparently there I also was as the wordless grandfather in Chocolat.
Did you have curly hair at any point in your life?
It was quite thick in those days. It would get curly if I had grown it out long. In those days, I had a bit of that, like, George Clooney kind of Caesar cut. Do you know what I mean? Where it's, like, kind of thick and, like, pulled down in the front, you know?
I think so.
Kind of quite Goomba-ish. Mm. But apparently, during the end of my university career, I blacked out and, like, flew over, auditioned for Lasse Hallström, and, like, appeared in a few scenes of this film, and then, like, got back in time to, like, you know, finish my thesis on Henry James. So, there you go. The evidence is there for all to see. Sean, the other thing that I think you feel was good in this movie is Juliette Binoche.
Yeah, I mean, I said early on that she was quite winning. That was what I used.
Regularly in the early part of this film, you kept saying, well, the movie's shit, but she's good. Do you still stand by that, having watched the whole thing?
I mean, I think she's really hampered by a very, very bad film. Did I mention it was bad? She's like, listen, I've got a job, I'm going to do it right, okay? She's charming, she's funny, she's sexy. We talked about Blue in the previous episode, you know, where she was chilly and removed and distant, and we've talked about her in Damage. The thing is that, like, I think more or less when she does English language roles, she gets a bit of a hard bargain because English language films are just not as sophisticated as European films.
Well,
but she does have a warmth to her that is completely takes over the whole screen while she's there. And she's a great actress, you know? I really appreciate her in this. Does she deserve an Oscar nomination? No, but this film didn't deserve any Oscar nominations.
Well, the thing is, like, I think every European actress, you already mentioned Penelope Cruz with her ill-fated performance in Woman on Top, like, they all seem to go through this phase, right? if they have any kind of American success and Hollywood discovers a European actress, they all seem to make these choices, this period of time where they... nobody quite knows what to do with them. They probably take, like, phonetic English lessons to, like, improve their English a bit more. Like, Juliette was kind of perfect for The English Patient, where she's meant to be a French-Canadian nurse, and she is warm and winning, and she won the Oscar. And then I'm sure people were like, let's put this woman in all kinds of other vehicles. And Juliette probably had a kind of 3 or 4 year, you know, delusion that maybe this was worth her time. And Chocolat, I think, is like probably like the apogee of her appearing in these kind of shit, fake European art trash.
Can you remember any other English language roles she's in, apart from Godzilla, of
Dan in Real Life with Steve Carell. I don't know if that's good or bad. Yeah, there's Godzilla. I guess Clouds of Sils Maria is actually an English language role, but that is like,
so good.
It is so good, but that's
I
really,
love that film so much.
That's a sort of European co-pro and
it
much
is.
Later. But what I think so interesting, like, Juliette clearly had a moment where she was like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to cash in the paychecks. Penelope had this moment as well. And then Julia, at least, was then like, no, 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 I'm going full Hanukkah, I'm going full, like, auteur on you, I've got to get back to, like, actually being an actress. And she entered, like, that whole other rich kind of later middle-age phase of her career that we talked about in the earlier episode. Yeah, drowning in chocolate was not for Juliette.
Yes, Juliette drank the poison. Brian, this film has completely turned me off chocolate, permanently.
Really? You'd much rather eat sardines, would you?
Oh, I have some right in front of me right now.
What if this was set in Lisbon and it involved someone who opened up a shop that was made entirely of tin fish?
That exists, babe. We were there.
I know, but maybe it was opened by some, like, magical... maybe it's like Carmen Maura as like a stranger who comes to town and, like, tells everyone... inside these little tins are a magical world. You can put anything inside a tin.
Sure.
Hope, love, faith. Just open it up and see what's inside.
I want to move away from magical realism, Brian. Oh, wait. Are we, though? We're moving into something incredibly weird and wacky.
Yes. So, for our very last Juliette Binoche episode, and actually probably our last regular installment before we take a summer hiatus, we are going all the way back to one of Juliette's earliest French roles, one that you and I are both really excited to have seen and to have talked about. There's absolutely no bad blood between us. Do not call me Taylor. Do not call him Katie. You know, it's not a feud.
No,
it's not a feud. It's all perfectly harmonious, and we hope that you'll join us as we conclude this series. In the meanwhile, if you don't have any idea what you're talking about, you'll maybe get some clues at our Twitter, at Broad Appeal Pod. I am also at BA Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X.
Au revoir, which only means we'll see you again.
Bye.